We're going to start with Artik. RT. Just the way they've done it for thousands of years in India. And so if you'd like to step up to the altar, we'll chant the Govinda prayer. Michael is our resident pujari, the attendant. And so you're welcome to, if you would like to move up closer, and you can stand. If you, generally one stands during the Arati. And this is an offering of the various elements of creation back to the source of creation, Krishna. So Michael will do the Arati. And this is accompanied by two mantras. One is called Govinda or Brahma Samhita. And that's, you'll come to know that melody. And then there's the Krishna mantra, since this is Krishna's teachings here at our Sunset Gita. So here we go. Like to chant that with me? Oh, yeah. that we...
Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare
to perform the Arti ceremony. Yes, your candidacy has been noted. Just see myself or Michael, and we'll be happy to show you. It's a very simple service, and something that you can do as a daily ritual at home. That word ritual should not be intimidating. There's ritual, and then there's ritual. If you go to the root of spiritual ritual, religious ritual, it's a channel for devotional emotion. It's a structure that allows you to bring your love to Krishna, to the divinity, in a way that has withstood the test of time. This isn't an invented performance. Arti ceremony, there are images of the Arti ceremony going back thousands and thousands of years in India. And like chanting of japa, which we can do later if there's time, you have your japa beads there. What you bring to that experience is what makes the difference between what we might call hollow ritual or mechanistic, mechanical ritual, and ritual that's actually spiritually rewarding. So what you bring to it is what makes it meaningful. Right? So my dear friend Nick is here, just returned from India. And we have another friend who's just back from India as well. I invited Nick to tell us a little bit about his time there, because from the little bit that I've heard of it, there have been some pretty extraordinary experiences. So this is Nick Valkov, whose studio is Agora Yoga in Astoria, Queens. And it's this lovely place where there's a wonderful, heartfelt community of people. And so if you're ever in Astoria, Queens, I urge you to visit Agora Yoga. And you've been thinking about taking this trip for some time, I think.
Yeah, right? Definitely. Yeah. Definitely.
What made it possible? Why now? Why did you kind of commit to going on this trip now?
It was very much just a coming together of perfect circumstances, because it was being led by Jules, who I had a great experience with at teacher training. He's a fantastic teacher and a really good storyteller and good public speaker, and so he's very easy to learn from. So he was organizing the trip. I had been curious about the origination of this asana practice that I do. So I thought India would be a good place to ask some questions and find out. And also I had seen and heard Radhana Swami speak here twice. Each time I heard him tell a story, I was always like so captivated by his stories. So I was like, if I'm going to be in India with him at the temple and the ashram that he lives at, I'll probably hear some great stories. Maybe these are all selfish reasons that I went, But I mean, that's what motivated me. It was like coming together of perfect circumstances.
So. And where did you arrive, and how long did you stay in India?
Okay, so we arrived in Mumbai on a Thursday night. We spent a night in a hotel close to the airport, and then we went, we drove to the Eco Village Ashram.
Now, what is an Eco Village Ashram?
So the Eco Village Ashram, this is one of Radhana Swami's brain children. It's a little village. It's a little village with a school and maybe 50 people on this plot of land that farm, and they make their own mud brick houses, and they make their own clay cups, and they cook there on the premises, the things they grow. And they're initiating these efforts around India of how other people can follow more eco-friendly lifestyle choices. And they're pioneers in this, and they're very, like, this very hard-working group of people that have, like, a really benevolent mission to make India better. And that's kind of what the community is. They have a shala there. They have these, like, cows. You can feed the cows. They're so friendly. They have great scenery and hiking all over the place. And then we had a life there in the ashram for about 2 weeks. And then about 14 days we had life on the ashram. And then it was back to Mumbai. We spent time going to the temple there where Radhana Swami lives. And then we had this amazing flower festival. I can tell you all about these things. It's all of these things that we did are all because of Radhana Swami's passion and drive to like do stuff and like create stuff. And there are a lot of reasons to go to India, but at the risk of sounding like I'm on a soapbox, it's a really inspiring experience that anyone should do. If it's a questionable experience for you in any way, I would say put it at the top of your priority list and go. And be around this man, Radhana Swami. He's a really inspiring person. And I would really like to take an opportunity to give him some credit for what he does, because he has created a program in India that creates little meals, individual meals for kids. And they make enough of these meals for 1.2 million of these underprivileged children.
Now, that's every day.
That's exactly. Every day, 1.2 million.
And you have to think about that number for a while.
It's
1.2 million plates of hot food delivered to indigent school children every day. That's a lot.
Now, okay. Yogeshwar was kind enough to mention this little Mickey Mouse program I have on Astoria called Agora Yoga. Now, this thing, I remember the effort I had to put into getting this little program running, which serves 150 yogis a day. When I got this thing done, I was patting myself on the back, and I was telling, man, job well done. Look at me go. Okay, that's 150. His program is 1.2 million. That's unbelievable. I was exhausted after the little Mickey Mouse 150 program. And what he's done. Now, okay, that's extraordinary in and of itself. But this is also the guy that when you talk to him, you sit on a cow dung floor. He invites you to speak to him. You sit down and you talk to him on the floor. He invited us up to his private quarters at one point. I'm pretty sure he sleeps on the floor on this like straw mat. And in his room, he's got a picture of Prabhupada. He's got a photo of Krishna. He's got a very simple bookcase, a very simple altar. He has a desk that had some like Apple product cords, so I think he's got a laptop or something.
He likes Apple.
Yeah, yeah. I thought that was like really cool. And then that's it. And you know, when you speak to this man, it's on one hand I feel only enough nervousness that I'm trying to like watch my behavior. I want to honor his custom. I don't want to do something unknowingly offensive, though I don't think you can actually offend Radha Swami at all, you know, but unless you're mean or something. But there's that side of a slight nervousness. But more than the nervousness is, he's a really calming person to talk to. He's like this. I meditated on this and I tried to figure out why I felt so calmed in his presence. And I remember the feeling I used to have as a kid when there was like that one cool neighbor in the neighborhood, like the adult who was like cool, and like the one adult of the neighborhood who you felt was kind of like a kid too. And all the other adults were like, they were adult people, but then this one adult person was kind of like the kid. He was like cool. And that's what Radha Swami feels like. He's like that guy in the neighborhood who was just cool, and like he'd help you out if you needed, and he'd leave you alone if you needed, and he just did his thing, and he was just like the nice guy of the neighborhood. And this guy who creates these programs and feeds all these kids is that humble about it. And I would speak to him about, I had like a couple injuries back in the day. And I talk about that all the time. People around me are sick of me talking about my like injuries that I have. But it just dominates my life. And that's all I can think about sometimes for conversation. And he listens to me. And then he, all the time when I'm telling him about, like, you know, breaking a bone or whatever, his response is always like, wow, that's amazing. What a journey you've been on. It's always this positive response. And it's really easy to feel like the victim when you get injured. And actually, a lot of the response I get from people is, you know, I'm so sorry. Oh, you poor thing. Oh, you know, is there anything I can do to help? You know, which sounds nice, but sometimes they have the tone of, I think you're just trying to, you know, patronize me a little bit. But he's the guy who gives me the response of what an amazing journey I've been on. He makes me feel so positive, you know. I leave a conversation with him feeling like I'm amazing. And I don't think it's me, I think it's you know, with anyone. He sees these like great things in people. And I feel so amazing. And I'm thinking, man, yeah, man, you know, it's like I'm a survivor, man. I can go through anything. Yeah, I'm great. And then, you know, you flip through his book. And he almost drowned in the Ganges. He gets chased around Istanbul with guys with daggers, almost dies. He has to, like, outwit these guys. He goes to the hospital. He has dysentery. He's in a hospital, Indian hospital, for 10 days. And here he's telling me, that's an amazing journey you're on. Oh, wow, you know. It's really a great lesson in humility. And he deserves credit for that because, you know, too few people. I don't know. I mean, he reaches a lot of people, but unless every person in the world knew about how gracious he is about his accomplishments, then it's too few people, you know? And what it does, it's created an atmosphere at this ashram of really, I say the word impeccable service, but that's to sound like, you know, I'm trying to buy some kind of, you know, a service for sale or something. It's not like that, but it's this heartfelt service among the devotees at the ashram. And the best example I have of this is we wanted to take a hike. There's big hills, mini mountains around this ashram. And one day we had on the schedule that we were going to take a hike. It's 90 minutes uphill to go to the top of this hill. And there's temples along the way to see. The day before we're going to go, a few of the monks got to talking and they decided to scrap that plan because it's a little bit of a dangerous hike. I mean, you're using arms and legs and there's some slippery spots. So they wanted to scrap the idea. A few people had like moans and groans and they protested. One day we're at lunch and one of the, he was like a middle-aged guy who was there with his wife, not particularly interested in the asana. Well, we did asana, he would fly kites and he kind of did his own thing. And he talked to one of the monks and got the monk to take him up this hill, escorted him up this hike. He comes down later that day, and as we're sitting around, he's showing us the photos on his phone. Look at that, man. Oh, look at that view. Look at this temple. And a few of us are seeing this, and we're like, oh, man, like this guy went on the hike. We want to go on the hike. And so the few of us that were here, this guy, Ajay is his name, who went on the hike, he said, you got to keep it quiet because we're not supposed to go. You have to get Jules' permission secretly about this. They don't want to take a big crowd up there. Once one person hears about it, everyone's going to want to go. It's got to be small. You know, keep it really quiet. So he said, okay, so we go. He said, which monk was it? And he points out, it's a guy named Vrudras. Vrudras is amazing. We went to go talk to Vrudras. Can we go on the hike? He goes, sure, you can go on the hike. It's no problem. I'm here to serve, but you have to ask Jules. And if Jules says it's okay, I'll take you. We're like, all right, great. Go sneak around, ask Jules. Jules says yes. And so now we go on the hike the very next day. We go on this hike. It's no joke. It's 90 minutes uphill. It's exhausting, and it's arms and legs, and as you're grabbing onto a root, if you're lucky, and you got to pull yourself up. And not all the people on the group made it all the way up. Vrudras made it up. I mean, he does this hike, but it's an exhausting hike. Saw beautiful temples, saw a beautiful view, and we walked down 90 minutes. It was literally 90, not like 70 that felt like 90. 90 minutes, literally. Down was even harder than going up because you have to kind of squat so you don't like slip down. And so you're using, I think, even like more muscle use than going up. When we got to the bottom, I was exhausted. They just started serving lunch. I made a beeline for the lunch line. I had like 3 servings, you know, 3 trips to the buffet line. The food's amazing. And after that, I'm ready for a nap. I go take a shower. I go take a nap. And by that evening, I'm feeling great. Now, Vrudras. He took that hike with us. We asked him. We asked him once. And just asking him once, he said, absolutely, I'll take you. There was no question. He said, yes, I'm going to take you. And he did this exhausting hike. When he finished the hike, he got in the lunch line to serve food. And then he ate whatever was left when everyone else got their food. Then he had to clean up all those pots that they put the food in. He goes to the kitchen, cleans them. As soon as the cleaning's done, it's time to make dinner for that night. So while I'm taking a nap, Vrudras is in the kitchen cooking dinner. Then he's in the line serving the dinner, all with a smile. And then when we're done with that, he goes to clean those pots, and then it's time to kirtan, and Vrudras dances kirtan with energy more than anybody. Now, this day that we take this hike, I was exhausted, and I, you know, got my food as quick as I could, and I took a nap, and it was like me. Vrudras did that hike, and he did all that service afterwards. But Vrudras did that hike for a second day in a row. He did that same hike the day before. And you never would have guessed it based on his energy level that day before that he had just done that hike. He wasn't taking a nap or anything. The day before that, Vrudras had taken us on this walk to the Vaitrana River. And he was one of the monks who swam all the way across the river and then all the way back. Now, in addition to all this stuff, all of this, you know, strenuous extracurricular activities, this guy was also up at 5 a.m. praying and dancing kirtan mosh pit. They dance, they are no joke. These guys party. They are crazy. They dance. It's the bhav. They feel it. And they do that all morning long. That's from about, you're usually from like 5 to like 5:45, and then it's like, you know, prayer for an hour and a half, and usually by 8 o'clock, it's like dancing time. He did all that, and then went on these extracurricular activities. Now, not only any of that. Now, okay, so Vrudras has like superhuman strength. Great, you know. Still, he would have been perfectly justified to tell us when we asked him if he'll take us on this hike. He'd been perfectly justified to say, "Listen, man, I went yesterday. Please." Give me a day off. I promise I'll take you tomorrow. I swear I'll take you tomorrow. But just today, you know, perfectly justified to say that. We would have said no problem, but no way. We asked him once, and the first chance he had to serve, he took it. And, you know, it's like, it's one of those things, I don't know if I, like, thanked him enough. That didn't dawn on me until a couple days later. He doesn't make any effort to make sure you know, just so you know, I did this yesterday. I just want you guys to know. Nothing like that. Don't even realize until it's too late, and so he just did all this stuff without like a real proper thanks, you know.
What it sounds like is that was this your first trip to India?
Yeah.
It sounds like It was the caliber of the people you met there was as important to you as the places you visited. Would that be accurate?
Oh yeah, the caliber of the people is really inspiring, and that's why I think, like, you know, I think everyone should go, because, you know, I catch myself a lot, you know, sitting on the subway for 90 minutes and then getting off and saying, oh, I'm exhausted, you know. Instead of, you know, feeling a kind of bov and having energy to, like, do something, you know. And they set a really great example of that. And I think that they do it without thanks. I think it's, you know, I think it's important that everyone know what kind of a level of service exists, because then we can feel motivated. I could, for sure. And but the experiences too. I mean, when we did this flower festival, it was another you know, manifestation of an idea of service. But I mean, they really, Radhana Swami really knows how to, like, put on a good show. I don't know who choreographed.
I think we may need just to give a brief description of this flower festival. Mm-hmm. That I've also experienced that, mm-hmm. and it really is memorable. They basically collect every flower available for about a 10-mile radius around the temple, off the farms and fields. Mm-hmm. And for about 2 weeks or so, I guess, before the flower festival, people are picking the petals off of flowers and filling these huge vats. I mean, as this thing is being prepared, there's literally 8-10 feet wide vats filled with flower petals. And you really wonder, what are they going to do with all those flower petals? Then the day of the festival comes. I mean, you can describe this if you'd like.
I mean, it's awesome. The day of, first, I really have to hand to, you know, Sharon G and Jules G. I mean, they really put together something awesome. As we walked up to the Mumbai temple, all red, and you saw lines out.
How many
out
people were on this trip with you?
On the trip, there was a little under 50 of us. I think maybe if you count Sharon and Jules and Hachi, maybe that would be like 50 people about.
And how many people were there for the flower festival?
Thousands. I mean, it was hard to say for sure, because when we walked into the temple, there's already a long line forming out. But of course, Radhana Swami extended this, like, ultra VIP pass to, like, Sharon and her 50, you know, disciples. And we were ushered in right away, passing the long queue of people, passing outer rooms where there were people like this, shoulder to shoulder, with their knees together, trying to take up as little space as they could, watching the event on a TV screen in front of them. There were several of those rooms on the outside of the main floor temple, so we walked through those. So those are full of people, and I know there's rooms on the other side, which we didn't go through, so, you know, there's more people there, you know, I'm assuming. And then we walked into the main hall, where, again, everyone is, like, close like this. And I think the main hall could have been, I'm just a really bad judge of, like, numbers. I mean, it's, I don't know, a room maybe, like, three times as big as this, everyone, like, together. And we got all the way up to the front, where there was this, like, you know, roped-off section, where we all sat, like, the front and the center, like this, because we had so much room, you know, like this. I mean, they really, like, made it, like, it really made us feel very, like, special. Everyone was cool. We saw the monks on the crowd. They were all waving to us. It was really cool. And it starts with, like, a really energetic kirtan. And people are singing. And, like, the energy is high. And after a while, they open up the altar. And there are the deities, the images of the deities, already draped in flowers and lilas and garlands. And so already the altar that you've been seeing all week is now even more spectacular and, like, even more of a vision. And then Radhana Swami comes to speak, and he tells us, and he speaks from the Gita, and told us the story of when Krishna took the bull. You know, it was Krishna boy, he was the boy, and he took the bull by the horns and defeated the bull. And then he told us about the importance of the flower festival, which was to offer even just a flower petal to Krishna.
That's the verse in the Bhagavad Gita, actually. In the Gita, Krishna says, if one offers me with love and devotion a leaf, a flower, a fruit, or some water, I'm pleased to accept it. What it means, of course, is that to reach the highest levels of spiritual achievement, full self-awareness, full God realization, does not require any spectacular credentials or qualifications. You don't have to be a Sanskritist. You don't have to be born in a Brahmin family. You don't have to have years of deep philosophical study. If you take a flower and offer it to Krishna with some love and devotion, he will accept that. And by Krishna's pleasure, by that acceptance, the soul's love is stimulated. So it's available to anyone.
Yeah.
And I think that's what this festival shows too, doesn't it?
It was like an unbelievable spectacle. They start, after Rana Swami finished speaking, the lights came down low, and then some really nice blue lights came up, and it really made the light show look good. And the altar is well lit, and then two monks from behind them show up, and they have handfuls of flower petals, and they just start with one solid color and big handfuls of yellow, bright yellow flower petals, and they just start over the deities. And once they start, it just looks awesome. It just has these flower petals falling in front of the deities, and everyone just starts Haribol, and then the kirtan gets louder, and so now everyone's energized. And so first you see yellow flower petals, yellow, and then after a while it's like a firework display. Then here comes the purple ones, purple, and everyone's whoa, and then it's a new color, and everyone gets crazy for the new color, and then there's more, and then those colors, once they do it so well, once that one color covers up all the old color, I don't even know how they can tell, but the new color covers up the old color, then they start with the new color after that, red, and it's everyone's cheering. Now all of a sudden these flower petals, they start building up and up around the deities, so they're almost neck high for the deities. And then another monk comes up, and he's sort of in the orchestra pit, and he gets all the flower petals down there. And then about two other monks, and one monk who brought up jewels actually, they go into the orchestra pit, and then they just start having waiting pool party with the flower petals. They start start flicking them up like this, and it's almost the flower petals are going Krishna's giving them back or something. And now we're gonna
That scene in The Sorcerer's Apprentice, where Mickey Mouse starts conducting the pails of water, and before you know it, there's this tsunami, there's this flood, this ocean of water. It's a little bit like that with flower petals.
Absolutely. They just, they were jumping in there, and they're flinging them up, and Jules was in there with these with these orange robe swamis, and just throwing it up. It was really cool. And then it just becomes, and then you can see, it's they're throwing it up so fast, and they have such handfuls that it's there's always flower petals continuously suspended in the air. Then after that party gets going and kirtan's even louder now, you look up around you, and then at one point I just saw these other monks are in these little lookout holes among the top, and they're up to something, and something's gonna happen, and it's dark, and it's the lights are just looking good, and then they come out with these big handfuls of flower petals, and then they start throwing flower petals down on the crowd. And now all of a sudden,
these are these little balconies that circle the temple room. So you've got the whirlwind of flower petals going on down below, and then you've got this shower of flower petals going on from above.
It's and it's nonstop. It's literally raining flower petals.
I don't remember exactly how many tons they prepared.
This year was 1.5.
1.5 tons of flower petals. Yeah. Just to give you an idea.
This was on Saturday. It was on a Saturday. This past Saturday.
And, what I remember being in that whirlwind of flower petals, first you can't see it. You can't see your hand in front of your face.
It's so many.
There's this kind of current of wind that starts happening between the kirtan and all of the activity and the movement, so that the flower petals, it really is like a tornado of flower petals, and you're caught up in this thing, and it's about as close, I think, as you can get to transcending your body in this lifetime.
Yeah.
Because the world disappears.
Yeah.
You're in a cloud of chanting and flower petals and people just ecstatically dancing.
And the fragrance, the scent of all these flowers, it just smells amazing in there. It's You know, you're just covered in flowers everywhere. Yeah, it's really special. It's a really special experience, and I don't know how else you could ever have something like that. You know,
what would you say is the bottom line? What is it that most stays with you, other than of course this visual memory of the flower festival? What would you say you took away from this trip to India?
Well, that, you know, the life of the life of devotion is an amazing life. It's an amazing life, and they have it's like a really good vibe, and it's really great people, and it's I don't know if the devotional life is for everybody. Maybe someone else goes and they're not into it or something. But you know, it's the experience I had. It was a very inspiring place. It's a good place. That lifestyle that they have there is a good place to go when you need like a little pick-me-up of inspiration. If things get mundane, it's I'm a material guy, I know I am, and when, you know, so it was a good place to, you know, see how nice a non-material world really is, you know, good for inspiration and rejuvenation.
Yeah. Beautiful. Does anyone have any questions that you'd like to ask Nick about his trip there? Thank you.
Yeah.
How long was the trip ago?
It was the 9th to the 26th, so yeah, 17 days. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so if anyone is interested in signing up, there are other trips coming up, I would imagine. They do this periodically, right?
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, do you want another one? Lady Ruth is doing an immersion in India with Yogeshwari. Mm-hmm. I think this month, or in February.
And if you wanted to go to see this flower festival, it's every year at the same time.
Mm-hmm. At this time, yeah.
Yeah,
I think. How many people attend normally at the flower festival?
There must, I like thousands. Like I'm really, it was a lot. Thousands, I would say easily thousands of people. I think people had talked about that. That was a number people were throwing around. That there's like, you know, a couple thousand
people. When I was there, it filled the streets outside the temple for several blocks. So, in India, they do things big. I mean, you know, in India, you know, everything's
yeah.
big numbers.
Is it online? Mumbai.
No,
it's Mumbai. During the day.
Mumbai Temple, yeah.
It's during the day.
Yeah,
during the day. So thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just to kind of a little bit of housekeeping. 2 weeks ago, it was. We're discussing a verse from the fifth chapter, Vidyavinaya Sampane Brahmane Gavihastini Suniceva Svapake Cha Pandita Samadarshanaha. The humble sage, by virtue of true knowledge, sees with equal vision a learned and gentle Brahmin, a cow, an elephant, a dog, and a dog eater. So people were expressing appreciation for this photograph from the Tiger's Preserve of a little girl with a baby orangutan. So I made copies, and if you'd like to take one home, you're welcome to do so. You can pass those around if you would. Let me just announce again, if I may, that Radhanath Swami will be guest at a weekend workshop next June, this coming June 28th and 29th on Long Island, about a half-hour train ride from Penn Station. Not very hard to get there at a very beautiful place called Old Westbury Gardens. So would you like to pass these around? This will give you a link to the website and additional information if you're interested in attending. And also the Bhagavad Gita that you have in front of you is yours to take home if you wish. Like everything else here at Sunset Gita, it's by donation. So if you'd like to make a donation, you're welcome to. But if that's problematic, you're welcome to just take the book home for yourself. All right. Well, now, that was an exciting beginning. Thank you so much, Nick, for that. The last 2 weeks, not last week, because we were snowed out last week, weren't we? But the 2 weeks before, we had a kind of beginning of the year overview of the Bhagavad Gita by looking at the Gita from two points of view. One is the Gita in time, the Gita as a historic text, and the other was the Gita as a transcendent work, as a wisdom text, the Gita outside of time, if you will. And we looked at the different ways of studying the Bhagavad Gita sociologically, pedagogically, cosmologically, and mystically. The mystical dimension of the Bhagavad Gita was the subject of the second part of our discussion. And just because I happen to be enamored of physics, we made a brief connection with some of the recent findings in fields of subatomic physics, which tend to support the idea that there is a greater mystery out there. To shorthand it, the world is more mysterious than it seems. What we look at and what we can perceive with our limited material senses is only a part of the picture. And so the Bhagavad Gita is talking about that deeper dimension, the part of reality that we cannot perceive with our senses. That which can be tested in the Vedic texts, the Bhagavad Gita and the other ancient Sanskrit texts, have always proven to conform with experiment. For example, this is an example that Prabhupada used to give, relating back to his childhood, growing up in early 20th century India. He was born in Calcutta in 1896. And so many of the examples that he gave came from a world that was before the internet and Google. So he would reference that in the Vedic text, it says that cow dung is antiseptic. The Vedas say if you touch stool, feces, whether it be human or animal, you must immediately go and bathe. Feces are considered contaminating. You must immediately wash. In fact, sometimes people are surprised that in India, traditional families don't use toilet paper. Toilet paper is considered a very unsanitary way to clean yourself. And I was always kind of wondering about that because that's how we all grew up in the West. And I would wonder, well, what evidence is there of that? And this one person who grew up in India said, well, here's a simple explanation. If by accident you touch feces, do you clean your hands with a piece of paper or do you go and wash them? Any discussion? Yeah. So in India, in the bathrooms, you'll see a brass, what's called a lota, a brass pot that's used. So you clean yourself with water. That's the way it's done in India. The Vedas say that touching any kind of excrement is contaminating. You must immediately go and cleanse yourself with water. However, the same Vedic texts also say that the dung of a cow is antiseptic and purifying. And it can be used as a poultice. If you have cow dung, it's used for fuel. If you have a cut, it's pure. There are no impurities in cow dung. So you can use it as a kind of poultice on a wound. So the Vedas describe these two things. They seem incompatible, and yet it holds up to, if you analyze cow dung, you'll find that it is indeed antiseptic. And Nick was telling us just a few minutes ago about how if you go into a home in India, cow dung will be used to coat the floors, the walls, the ceilings, and they'll even do designs in cow dung around the room. And it's used for heating and for cooking. So those parts of the Vedas that can be experimentally proven have always shown themselves to be accurate. There are calculations, for example, of the distance between the Earth and the Sun, the Earth and the Moon, that are extraordinarily close to most recent mathematical and cosmological, not cosmological, but, you know, astronomical calculations. Within a very, very short difference, those numbers are the same. There are parts of the Vedic texts, and in particular the Bhagavad Gita, that cannot be experimentally proven except by undertaking the experiment within yourself. You can't calculate, for example, the presence of the soul except by its symptoms. The Bhagavad Gita talks about how the body, the material body, is animated by the presence of an infinitesimal, infinitely dynamic spiritual soul called Atma in the Bhagavad Gita. And the whole second chapter of the Gita is about how you, the real person, the energetic source of consciousness within this body, you are more powerful comparatively than the sun. The way one sun can illuminate the entire universe with heat and light, the soul within the body is compared to 10,000 suns. It's so small. Well, that can't be experimentally proven, but by undertaking a devotional life, a life of meditation, chanting, study, gradually awareness of ourselves as spiritual beings is revealed, it's revived, it's there within us, and the practices are the way of reviving what's already there. So each week we go into another verse of the Bhagavad Gita, and now that we've started our eighth year, and we're in the fifth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, if you have, I don't know if it's the same page count in the hardbound edition as in the paperback, but it's the fifth chapter, verse 20. What does anyone remember? Is it 21, I think we're doing, yeah? So if you look on page 235 in the paperback edition, fifth chapter, verse 21, we can chant the Sanskrit together, and then we'll discuss the verse and the purport or commentary. So would you repeat the invocation after me, and then we'll chant the verse. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
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 So we'll use the standard melody that we usually use when we chant the verses from the Bhagavad Gita. Bhayasparshe svasaktatma. I'm going to try that with me. It's a little hard because of these connections and the diacritic marks. So I'll say that before we use the melody. Baya
sparshe
shvasaktatma. Shvasaktatma. Baya sparshe svataktatma. Baya sparshe svataktatma. Baya sparshe svataktatma. Bayas varshes vatak patmaha vindatyatmani yat sukham. Vindatyatmani yat sukham. When you have V's or Y's at the end of a word and the next word begins with a vowel, it's as though those two words are linked together. So in this case, it's vindyatma, vindatyatmani. Vindat yatmani yat sukham. Vindat yatmani yat sukham. Vindat yatmani yat sukham.
Vindatyatmanihyatsukham Sabrahma Yoga Yuktatma Sabrahma Yoga Yuktatma Sabrahma Yoga Yuktatma Sabrahma Yoga Yuktatma Sukham Akshayam Ashnute Sukham Akshayam Ashnute Sukham Akshayam Ashnute Sukham Akshayam Ashnute
When you have a dot under an S or an acute accent over an S, it's pronounced like SH. Sh. Okay? So let's try this once again. I'll chant one line, then we chant it together.
Vaya svashe svashaktatma Vaya svashe svashaktatma Vindatyat maniyat sukham Vindatyat maniyat sukham Sabrahma yoga yuktatma Sabrahma yoga yuktatma Sukham akshayam ashnute Sukham akshayam ashnute
Anybody feel like trying? Really? Go for it. All right. Brave one.
Maya sparshe shvatak tatmaha Vindat yat mani yat sukham Sabrahma yoga yuktatma Sukham akshayam ashnute
Bravo! Well done. Very, very well done. Excellent, excellent. Such a liberated person. Now, such meaning referring to the previous verse. So let's go back and read the previous verse. A person who neither rejoices upon achieving something pleasant nor laments upon obtaining something unpleasant, who is self-intelligent, who is unbewildered, and who knows the science of God is already situated in transcendence. We did discuss this and I believe the bottom line in our talk about this was not that detachment means indifference, but rather in a devotional life, if anything, we're more attached to doing everything we do as perfectly as we possibly can. But we do not allow the results of what we do to define us. And I do recall now mentioning to you, I guess we've all had a boss like this at some point in time, somebody I used to work for who was a delightful fellow as long as the company was doing well. If the company fortunes were in the can, so were we. And he was the worst, most obnoxious person. You just didn't want to be near him. Everything was bad. You couldn't do anything right because he's so identified with the success or failure of his company that it defined who he was. So the admonition here is commit wholeheartedly to the tasks of your life, but don't allow the success or failure of those tasks to determine your self-worth. We're spiritual beings, and as spiritual beings, we are whole, complete, and not defined by our material circumstance. Being impoverished is a condition of the material body, not the soul. Being rejected is a condition of the material self, not the soul. Feeling oneself unworthy is a material sensation. It does not apply to the soul. So Krishna is encouraging Arjuna, come out of this identification that you have with your temporal self, with the circumstances and the traumas and the anxieties and tensions of this life, remember who you really are and move from that place. So, such a liberated person, Krishna is saying in this 21st verse, such a liberated person is not attracted to material sense pleasure, but is always in trance, enjoying the pleasure within. In this way, the self-realized person enjoys unlimited happiness, for he concentrates on the Supreme. Boy, there's a lot. Each of these verses is a whole, you know, we can have a year's worth of discussion on any one of these verses. Quite possibly, I don't recall, but he's often quoting from Bhagavad Gita, so it's likely that he did. Now, here's the purport. Now, I hesitated at first. I'll admit this to you. I come to you, warts and all, and I tell you, you know, what my hesitations are when I have them. I hesitated to get into this verse because the purport, the commentary, touches on a delicate issue, but it needs to be discussed. We have talked about it before, and we're going to talk about it again. All right, so here's the purport. Sri Yamunacharya, a great devotee in Krishna consciousness, said, and I'm going to do my best to recite this verse of Yamunacharya, Yadavadi mama cheta Krishna padara vinde navanavarasa damani yudatamantama sit tadavadi batanari sangame smaryamani bhavati smukamakaram sushtu nushtivanam cha. Whew, now that's a mouthful. Here's the translation. Since I have been engaged in the transcendental loving service of Krishna, realizing ever new pleasure in Him, whenever I think of sex pleasure, I spit at the thought and my lips curl with distaste. And Prabhupada continues, he says, a person in Brahma, yoga, or Krishna consciousness is so absorbed in the loving service of the Lord that he loses his taste for material sense pleasure altogether. The highest pleasure in terms of matter is sex pleasure. The whole world is moving under its spell, and the materialist cannot work at all without this motivation. That is the test, but a person engaged in Krishna consciousness can work with great vigor without sex pleasure, which he avoids. That is the test in spiritual realization. Now here's one of the memorable sentences from Prabhupada's purports in the Gita. Spiritual realization and sex pleasure go ill together. A Krishna conscious person is not attracted to any kind of sense pleasure due to his being a liberated soul. All right. Now, what makes this difficult to talk about is not that it's embarrassing to talk about it or somehow impolite to talk about it. What makes it difficult to talk about is that it's a very complex subject. So much of our sense of ourselves is wrapped up in our sexuality that to separate ourselves from that dimension of our life becomes very threatening. It can undermine a lot of our sense of self-worth or self-worthlessness. If you don't think you're a particularly sexy person, then moving away from the erotic self can be a denial of the very thing you think most needs attending. It's possible, according to the bhakti tradition, according to the vision of souls as eternal entities who have a life. We have a life before coming into this world and into this body. And after leaving this world and leaving this body, we have a life, a real life. That eternal self is also an erotic being, but not erotic in the sense of the interaction of senses and hormones and neurological impulses and psychological impulses. The eternal erotic nature of the soul is ecstatic love for God. And through that original love, there's an extension of that love to all beings. Very often in the memoirs and writings of the celibates, the celibate monks and sadhus, sages, they'll talk about how giving up of the physical sexual self was not difficult for them, because they were experiencing the greater satisfaction of the intimacy of the greater community around them. By giving themselves to more people, there was a greater sense of fulfillment than the exclusive giving of oneself in a physical sexual relationship to one person. That may be difficult to imagine if we haven't had that experience. How is it possible? How can pastoral care for a large number of people possibly equate to a satisfaction greater than the pleasure one experiences in intercourse? How is it possible for those two things to be equated at all? There's this extraordinary evolution, spiritual evolution, that occurs as we progress with our chanting, as we progress with our wholehearted offering in the arti ceremony, as we progress in our study and discussion of Bhagavad Gita and other sacred texts, something happens. Something begins to happen. And it's really amazing. There is a gradual unfolding of a different kind of taste, a different kind of attraction. It's described in the Bhagavad Gita as param drishtva, a higher drishtva, a higher taste, a higher vision of things. That gradually you find yourself not forcing a detachment from the physical erotic self, but a very natural transfer of energy from that field of activity to the field of activity of the soul. It happens quite naturally. So a word of reassurance: there is no need to go crazy here. We're not talking about jumping headfirst into, you know, lifelong celibacy. The Bhagavad Gita talks about a gradual, natural transfer of energies. You also don't want to do any of that radical stuff. This comes up all the time. You know, this knowledge is so beautiful and so powerful. There's a tendency to want to just get into it. Take it from me, huh?
PDS.
What's that?
Post-devotee syndrome.
Take it from me. You don't want to jump headfirst into devotional life. You want to go into it with your eyes open and your feet on the ground. So develop your spiritual life, develop your Krishna consciousness. And when those moments occur, when you're feeling so excited about it, because it gets very exciting, you're discovering your immortal self, your eternal soul. What could possibly be more exciting than that? It's amazing. When those sensations start to come to the surface, it happens a lot in chanting. You have those beads in front of you? You take these beads in the morning, using the first and third finger, and chant on these beads: Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. That chanting Boy, that's magical. That there's. Well, that's a whole other class. We could talk about where the power of that chanting comes from. But it's so effective, it's so powerful, that it can reach a point where you just want to leave everything aside. You want to give it up. Just give everything else up and give yourself over to that. If that moment happens for you, bravo, wonderful. Take a deep breath. Slow down. Come to class. And we'll talk about it. Take this gradually, because if you take it too quickly, it can get very scary. It can be a scary thing. It is indeed a pulling of the rug out from underneath this whole construct that we've been working on all our lives. Seeing ourselves as entities in a business environment, in a cultural environment, in a socioeconomic environment, and certainly in a sexual environment. That sexual impulse, according to the Bhagavad Gita and other texts, originates in the soul's ecstatic love for Krishna. Why do we exist? We exist to exchange love. That love, if we forget that original relationship, the tendency is still there. It's like water. It may become ice, but if you leave it at room temperature, it reverts to its natural condition. There's a natural condition of the soul, which is ecstatic love. We are ecstatic beings. Why does the idea of joy and bliss appeal so much? It's because it's our nature. It's what we are by nature. No one says, I think I really want to be miserable today. That's not our nature. Misery is alien to us. Death is alien to us. Taking to devotional practice is reverting to the original nature of the soul and cultivating that nature. And it starts to come out in these extraordinary, wonderful ways. So it's there originally in that love for Krishna, for God in personal form. When we forget that, some souls forget that, the tendency is still there. What do you do with it? What do you do with that urge to love? You find some other place to put it. And it's why relationships, especially sexual relationships, are so problematic. Because it's the condition of an eternal, immortal soul attempting to find an adjustment to the world around him or her through the vehicle of material senses. It's not really compatible. It's a long subject that sometime we can have more discussion about. But the point that Prabhupada is making here in this verse, of course, is that a Krishna conscious person is so absorbed in the loving service of the Lord that he loses his taste for material sense pleasure altogether. You can live without sex. I don't think you can live for very long without a sense of intimacy, but you can live without sex. This sangha that we have here is for cultivating intimacy. It's for cultivating friendships. It's for cultivating a sense of trust. How many people can you actually trust? How many people can you actually reveal your heart and mind to and think that they're not going to betray you, they're not going to misuse that, they're not going to totally not get it? That, ideally, is what happens in the association of devotees. There's a prayer. I don't know why we stopped saying this prayer. We used to end every class with this prayer. Vanchakalpa tarubhyascha kripa sindhubhya evacha patitanam pavanevyo vaishnavevyo namo namaha. I offer my heartfelt prayer and obeisance to the Vaishnav devotees. Vaishnav means devotee of Krishna, devotee of God in personal form. Because the devotees of the Lord are like desire trees, kalpataru. In the spiritual world, there's this eternal realm that's described in the Vedas. The trees there are called kalpavriksha, desire trees. not only do they offer the fruit that they bear, but they also fulfill every wish. Whatever desire you may have, these trees in the spiritual realm fulfill those wishes. So this prayer says that you, as those who aspire to love for God, you are like those desire trees. Because your heart is so full with love and compassion for others, knowing that they're suffering in this world, just as we are. And we feel for them. Anyway, we should probably take that prayer up again. It's a lovely way to end the class. Any questions about this verse?
Maybe what we'll do is if you put out a group of prayers and make a poster.
Yeah.
That we can have in the class for like beginning and end.
That's a good idea. We can do that. Very nice. Like that.
I have a question. In I think it's in the fourth chapter that it's mentioned that there were a lot of great Krishna conscious people, a lot of great yogis, and I forget the name of that particular yogi. He had 100 children, and yet he was considered to be a fully Krishna conscious person.
Yes.
So how do those two sit together? That
it's a good question. You don't have to go back to Vedic times. If you go back to the 19th century, the great bhakti scholar practitioner Bhakti Vinod Thakur had, I believe, 13 children. That was Prabhupada's guru's guru. So his great grand guru. He was also a court magistrate, a judge in the British colonial administration. Wrote dozens and dozens of books in his lifetime, started community organizations across the Bengal area. Hugely active man in social and legal circles, and yet a pure devotee of Krishna, thoroughly, completely Krishna-realized being, with a very, very large family. And I'm glad you brought it up. There's nothing anywhere in the text that say that in order to achieve full God awareness, you have to be celibate. There's no such verse anywhere in the texts. The recommendation is that you try to reduce material activity so that you can increase your spiritual activity. That's the principle. The principle is, why get more entangled in things that are going to eat up your day than necessary? In a nutshell. There is utterly nothing wrong with wanting to come home and to get into bed with a loving partner. There's nothing wrong with that. Everybody, most everybody, would love that. Who doesn't want to feel loved and find comfort in the arms of a beloved? It's a lovely impulse. It's most rewarding when that commitment to another person is part of a commitment to a spiritually progressive life together. So that sex doesn't become the dominant theme. It becomes an embellishment on a partnership that is geared toward awakening love for God. And there is sufficient evidence that intimacy with a loved one, when it is a relationship predicated on Krishna consciousness, on that mutual striving to love God, is much more fulfilling and rewarding than sex in a vacuum. Sex without that mutual commitment. What makes sex enjoyable is the sense of commitment that occurs between two people. The pleasures themselves are biological and chemical interactions. This is where the real pleasure takes place, up here. So to incorporate that intimacy in a relationship that's committed to progressive spiritual life is to be accepted. And in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna even says, in that kind of a relationship, I'm that sex. I become that sex. That sex is an incarnation of God. When sex is part of that wholehearted commitment to devotional life, Krishna says, I am there. I am in that sex. So it's right there in the Bhagavad Gita. Anything can be undertaken properly if it's done with knowledge and in a devotional spirit. Yes, and Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, considered avatar of Krishna, was himself a sannyasi. He was a renunciant. Most of his followers were householders. They were married folks. And he himself was married. As a matter of fact, he was married twice. His first wife died in childbirth. Not in childbirth. His first wife died. I don't recall what the circumstances were. But he remarried. So he was married twice. And then became a sannyasi. And his main associates were family people. Usually you hear about, you know, the renunciants. They get the glory, they get the publicity. The work is often done by the community folks. You're all so quiet. How are you doing, Rodney?
Fine.
Good to see you again.
Yeah, good to see everyone. So I would say about the book you're talking about is like it's a beyond of us. Yeah, the love relationship is equal. And I say no one wrong with anyone. It's the love is beyond. It's like if you surrender to self and you're sure, it's pretty difficult. You know, if you just surrender the world and surrender your love to the person, it's like it's oneness inside. And it's like love of no boundaries. It's like samadhi. It's transcended every moment. No matter where you go, whatever you do, it's love. It's always there. You went to moving, you went here, you went there. It doesn't even matter. You're just beyond already. You stay in that state. Because that's the greatest state there is. You don't come out.
That's a very important point, what you just said. Material love, material pleasures, have a beginning, a middle, and an end. Pleasures on the spiritual platform never end. They're ongoing. And in fact, they grow deeper and deeper and deeper and deeper all the time. Yeah?
This isn't an easy thing to talk about, but I just thought I'd ask you, because when we were in India, we visited the Bhaktivedanta Hospital, another creation throughout Swami, a big hospital. And they told us about the wonderful things they do there. One thing they mentioned was that they don't perform abortions in the hospital. And it made me wonder a little bit about an abortion. Let's say there's an instance of, you know, sexual relations, a woman is pregnant. Should we try to create a world where abortions are outlawed?
At 9:20, you bring this up. You couldn't have brought it up when we had more than 10 minutes.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I thought about it, and yeah, I know. Maybe we save it for another time.
I think we may need to save this one for another time, because it's a very, very deep subject. It's a very important subject. I don't think we should give it short shrift. But let me perhaps just finish off, because I want anyone else who has any questions or comments to make to have a chance to do so. just by giving it a little bit of a larger context, okay? When we talk about these tricky issues, human sexuality, abortion, end of life, you know, should people have a right to end their life if they're in excruciating, unmitigatable pain? Right? I mean, there are all kinds of legal, moral, ethical dimensions to these issues. At least you're thinking about it, and that's important. That's what we're here to do. We're not here in this Bhagavad Gita weekly series to draw universal pronouncements about this is the way things must be in all times and under all circumstances. I don't think that's healthy. And it's certainly not the way of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Krishna tells Arjuna at the end, well, do what you think best. Right? And circumstances change. We can make some grand pronouncement today. Tomorrow things can be very different and it will no longer apply. So it's the sincerity with which you bring to the issue, to the question, that is perhaps as important, if not more important, than actually finding an answer to it. There was a recent interview on Charlie Rose with the actor Frank Langella. Really fine actor. He's done some marvelous work. And he recently did King Lear. Now, Lear is considered by actors to be... You don't do King Lear when you're young. You know, that is not a part you play. You wait till you've lived a life and you have something to bring to that character and that performance. And Langella, who is, I guess he's in his early 70s now, finally has played Lear. And Charlie Rose was asking about his interpretation of the part, and Langella was describing that, you know, he's seen so many different performances of King Lear. And he says, too often actors play Lear as though he's some, you know, madman who's, you know, developing Alzheimer's or something. And, you know, and he said for himself, he doesn't think that that's who Lear is. You know, because there are these mad scenes, you know, on the heath in the storm, you know, blow ye winds, you know, it's like really going crazy. And Langella's point is that he doesn't think that this is just some kind of wanton madness. He thinks that this is a man who's lived a life in full and he's coming to grips with death and he's coming to grips with what has he done with his life and what is he leaving behind. And he puts his daughters to a test and so on. And of course, that's the brilliance of Shakespeare, is that between the lines of the language, you find the human journey, you find the search for what is real. You know. Never mind reincarnation. You know, never mind next lives. I think there's nothing for you here now if you don't do that, if you don't examine your life in that way. I know a lot of my God brothers and God sisters in Krishna consciousness. They've got the philosophy down cold, but they've failed to examine their lives. And as a consequence, all that they can do when someone like Nick raises a very important and complex question is to feed back the party line. Well, that's not Krishna consciousness. That's not what's being exhorted by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. Right? We're here to think deeply about things and to go inside the experiences of our life to find Krishna there. He says there's verses where andantarastam paramanu chayantarastam param, within the atom God is there, within everything he's there, but you've got to look for him. He's not going to just pop out and start dancing for you. You have to go looking for him. That's your, you bring that to the spiritual journey and then he'll step toward you. So I don't have a satisfying answer to give you, Nick. That's a complicated question. But I love that you're asking the question. Thank you. Yes.
I can ask something off you. Did Krishna say to Arjuna that everything is God and man can't destroy anything of God's creation? So when Arjuna, when they're facing a war, Arjuna says he sees the enemy and he goes to Krishna and says, "These are all my kin. I can't go to war with them." Krishna says, "But I can't kill them." Krishna says, "Who are you to think that you could kill anyone? You can't kill them, they won't be killed. It's God's creation. But you do have to play your role because you are a warrior." Mm-hmm. I studied a long time ago, but that meant a lot to me. But it's been a long time. I wonder if I have it right.
Yeah, I think it's basically you do. Bearing in mind, with this one caveat, that Krishna is speaking to Arjuna, who is a very specific person with a very specific challenge that he's confronting, that's got him absolutely traumatized. And the answer that Krishna gives him is specific to him in that moment. All right? So that, again, drawing too many generalizations, I think, it can be problematic. At that moment, Arjuna needed to know that you cannot kill. You don't destroy. That's not your prerogative. Your job is to do the best you can. These souls will never be destroyed permanently, but they do not deserve to remain in power. They must be brought down. That's your assignment. Okay? Someone else, that would be the wrong message. For someone else who is not a soldier confronting a terrorist takeover, the message might be ahimsa. You know, the message might be, put down your weapons. Find a place of reconciliation. Dig deeper into your sense of compassion. That was not what was needed then. So it's just important to understand that circumstances often dictate. Wisdom and truth is not, yes, can it be engraved in stone as commandments and passed down? Yes, of course. But the practical application of wisdom is not something that you can pass down like a stone tablet. Because you are changing at every moment. The world around you is changing at every moment. The needs of a situation are evolving and shifting at every moment. So it takes study. It takes study. It takes discussion. That's why we're meeting every week. If it was a stone tablet, we can meet once and bang, we're done. We're out of here. Here's your tablets. Bye-bye. Takes discussion. Takes serious meditation. Yeah.
Oh, I was wondering, for those of us who are new to your class, would you give us a little bit of background about you as a teacher? And obviously, you're very enlightened. We're just curious as to how you got to be where you are today.
Well, that's our show for tonight. Thank you for coming. Sure, I'd be happy to do that, but because time is limited and I'm really reluctant to talk about myself, let's have a discussion afterwards, because we're going to wrap up, we're going to have our little vegan treat, and while we're having that little treat, I'd be happy to sit and talk with you. Is that all right? Okay. You want to make an announcement, Michael?
Please give us donations, it pays for our podcast, it pays for the books, it pays for the food, it pays for the flowers. And it's kind of empty tonight, so please remember to give
me... Michael's very good about doing this. Thank you all very much. We are going to be having some special events coming up this year. We'll talk more about that next week. And apropos next week, our guest next week, our very special guest speaker next week is my mom.
Wow.
her name is Adele. Affectionately known to family as Gigi. And she is just the coolest dame to come along in a long time. So if you come next week, I think you won't regret it. We're just going to talk about whatever. I'm sure she'll regale you with the stories of when her son joined the Hare Krishnas and you know, the breastfeeding that came out of that. And everything, but she's a very wise and funny and wonderful person. And I'm delighted that she accepted to be our guest next week, so I'll hope to see you then. Thank you all for coming. Thank you. Hare Krishna. Thank you.
All glories to you. I just figured it out.